The Cold War ended decades ago. Or did it? This hour, looking at Russia's actions in our 2016 election through the eyes of a former CIA officer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tom Twetten is a former deputy director for operations at the CIA. He's also a graduate of Iowa State University. Today, I ask him to give us his view of Russian election meddling and the much-talked-about meeting Donald Trump Jr. had last year. Before that, we begin our series of conversations with university and college presidents in Iowa. Today, the president of the University of Northern Iowa, Mark Nook. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Cold War ended decades ago, or did it? Well, this hour, later in the hour, we'll look at Russia's actions in our 2016 election through the eyes of a former CIA officer, in fact, a former deputy director for operations at the CIA, Tom Twetten, Iowa State University graduate with more than four decades of experience in the U.S. intelligence community. He'll be joining us in the second half hour. First of all, though, with summer zipping by and the fall semester only about a month away. Is that possible? Is the summer already getting away from us? Well, we're reaching out to Iowa College and University presidents to get a sense of the challenges facing institutions of higher education in the state. And joining us this half hour, Mark Nook is with us again, president of the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. President Nook, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ben. It's a great pleasure to be on board with you today.
We want to reach out to our listeners this half hour. President Nook will be with us for the next 20 minutes or so. If you have a question about the UNI or the state of higher education in the state, please join us. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. You could also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Looks like you've been in your position about half a year. February 1st, you started out. How have you been settling in?
Really well. You know, the people around Cedar Falls and especially here at UNI are so helpful to everyone, and they've made the transition, I think, as smooth as anyone could have expected. In fact, much smoother getting to know the university, the people of the university, the culture here, and also the relationship between UNI, Cedar Falls, Waterloo, the greater Cedar Valley, and then throughout the state as well, and into our alumni groups that are in other states. So it's just been a tremendous amount of support as we've come into the community for both Cheryl, my wife Cheryl, and myself.
Mm-hmm. A smooth transition, but what have been the bigger challenges during the transition, perhaps something you didn't expect?
Yeah, I don't know that there was anything that I didn't really expect at the time that we were interviewing and looking at the position. Of course, the legislature wasn't in session, and so you never know where the budget's going to go, but budgets have been an issue in states across the country for a little while. So it wasn't a surprise. It was just one of those things that you have to realize you're going to have to go to work on a budget
right,
whenever you get here. And coming in the middle of the session and in the middle of a semester is a little bit different, but it gave me a good opportunity to get to know some of the legislators and how the legislature operates, how to work with them during a session. So I wouldn't say there's been any really big surprises out there. I got a lot of really good information, and people were very helpful before my first day in getting me up to speed on where things were at and what the lay of the land was, both politically and culturally, as well as economically in the state and, mm-hmm. and especially in the Cedar Valley.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about appropriations, your budget, the Board of Regents, the governing body that oversees the public universities in just a minute. But first of all, I wonder if I could get your views on this. We're hearing all the debate about President Trump's travel ban. Well, the uncertainty likely to continue until the U.S. Supreme Court decides that order's constitutionality in many months' time. We've heard it's given many international students pause. It's worrying higher education administrators across the country. Are you seeing a dip in interest and enrollment by international students at all there at UNI?
Well, we haven't seen a dip in interest. We've actually seen an uptick. But, you know, we were doing some things to increase our visibility. We went to the use of the Common Application, which gets us in front of more international students. So we actually had an uptick in the people requesting information and the people submitting applications. But with that, also, we knew we'd have a decrease in the number of offers that people accepted. I think we're going to be down just a little bit this fall in our international student population. But until they get here and we sort of sort out, you know, who's coming from those restricted areas, who's not coming from those restricted areas, how does that look relative to other areas that aren't on that ban, we really won't be able to pull it apart and see what the effect of the travel ban really is on our enrollments. There's a number of other things going on as well that can impact those enrollments. So we're going to kind of wait and see until we've got everything in and then do some good analytics on the numbers and find out what it is that's really impacting things overall.
Mm-hmm.
But we will probably be down just a little bit. We did have several students, especially just after the first travel ban was announced, that, you know, wanted to meet and talk about how they stay informed and whether or not they should buy tickets home. And I think that was a very reasonable thing to do as it was announced. It was kind of a surprise to everybody. So we had to get to work on how we support them and make sure they've got the information they need to be able to make travel plans or decide whether or not they're traveling home. So we worked very closely with them. And I think some of that nervousness is still there, but most of the students from the impacted countries that I have gotten to know are planning on being back.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can recall what countries these students that sought sort of advice from your people, what countries were they from the affected countries, the six or seven in the travel ban?
Yeah, that's where they were, especially the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were, of course, wanting to know whether or not they should buy their tickets and whether or not they'd be able to get back home. And some of that we couldn't answer either, but we were trying to get you know, the best information we had, the best intelligence we had on what the likely impacts would be. And we were really, especially early on, just asking them to sit tight until everybody knew more about how the travel ban was going to work out and where it might go. But like I said, most of them have decided that they want to continue here and they want to finish their degrees here. They really love the education that they're getting and the close friends and ties with faculty and staff. And so if they stay here, they certainly want to do that.
But it sounds like some of these students did have their plans altered or decided otherwise. Did any of them actually return to their countries for good because of the uncertainty, because of the talk of immigration perhaps during the campaign?
I don't know of any of that at the moment. We'll know better of that in the fall once we get everybody to return. We've got all our enrollments in. We'll know that a little bit better after we get to our census data a few weeks after the opening of the fall semester.
Well, what part of the student body at the University of Northern Iowa comes from outside the United States?
You know, it's pretty small. It's about 1,000 students, so it's not a large group. About 10%, a little under 10%.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting.
In fact, it's smaller than that. That was a different number. It's about 5% of our total population is international.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to some budgetary issues here that you mentioned prior in just a few moments ago.
Sure.
Coming up in August, the Iowa Board of Regents Tuition Task Force, the Iowa Board of Regents, the governing body that oversees the state's public universities. They have a tuition task force and holding a public forum in August to hear from area students, residents about your university's long-term budget plans. Students are the share that the students will have to pay in that education in a public university. What do you expect to be the main points of concern at that forum?
You know, I think from a student's perspective and from a legislator's perspective, making sure that we do everything we can to hold the tuition to something that is that can be justified and generally speaking is reasonable and predictable for them as much as possible. I think our students are very concerned that we not let the tuition grow at a rate that they can't keep up with or that puts them in greater financial harm. We've done a great job of holding down our student loan rate here with several programs that we've put in place around Live Like a Student. We wouldn't want to see that go up very much. So we're going to be focusing on keeping our total cost, not just the total cost to students, but our actual expenses. You know, over the last 10 years, we've followed the consumer price index or inflation. So we're not increasing our expenses at a rate other than the inflation rate. But our tuition has gone up faster than that. And we'll be looking at that and talking about how we can try to keep our expenses at that inflation rate of the consumer price index and also hold our tuition there. But we'll need some help from the legislature and a partnership to be able to do that.
I understand students will see a 5% increase this fall at UNI, is that right?
That's right,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when you say you want to see that tuition increases are within a justified framework or reasonable, using words like justified and reasonable, can you quantify that in numbers, in percentage terms? What would be justified? What would be unreasonable?
Yeah. I think there's a couple things that you can take a look at and start to get some estimates on that. You know, over the past 5 years, if you take the consumer price index and take the five-year average, it's running around 1.75%. So if we were projecting out a tuition increase that was around 2%, that's the sort of increases that families would be seeing in the other expenses that they're running into. And so that would certainly be one way to look at reasonable or justifiable. I think that's probably reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
If we start to talk about justifiable, then we've got to look at both the sources of revenue that the university has. And if the university can hold its expenses to inflationary rate, something like a consumer price index, then those, assuming the breakdown, you know, it's between tuition and state appropriation. So if the state appropriation can't keep up at the consumer price index or inflationary rate, we'll have trouble keeping the tuition at that rate, or we've got to talk about an impact on quality. And that's just not something I'm willing to do. We've got to maintain the high quality that this university is really known for. And we've got ways to quantify that quality that we can demonstrate we're doing a lot better than an institution of our type generally does.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to maintain that.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like points you've been trying to drive home with Iowa legislators. You mentioned that part of the transition into this new position has been learning to work with Iowa legislators.
Yeah.
What have you learned about how to lobby them to see the value of higher education and your needs?
Well, you know, the legislature, each legislator has a different set of things that are important to them and different things that are impacting the people they represent. And so the better I can understand the people of their district and what's important to them, that helps out a lot. And, you know, being a kid from Northwest Iowa, from rural Iowa, I come at least with some background. It's been a while since I was in Iowa. So I've been out trying to meet with people around the state, trying to understand what some of those key factors are in some of the districts and talk with as many people as possible so that when I'm meeting with legislators, I understand the pressures and that they have on them and the things they're hearing from their constituents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and during the session, there's a lot of pressure on them. Things are moving fast. So we're trying to make some meetings this summer when they've got a little more time to sit and kind of work through some of the things that we're talking about, understand as much as possible about the things that impact, whether it's budget or quality of the education that we offer, all of those things, and answer any give them a chance to really ask us deep questions and help them understand the process better.
How optimistic are you about appropriations for the public universities in the coming legislative session?
You know, we understand, I think we all understand that right now the revenues in the state are, to be kind, soft. And it's going to be difficult for the state at the moment, at least with the current revenue estimates, to be able to fund the state as well as they have. And so it's going to be, you know, we've all got to have an eye open to that, that we're going to be in a soft appropriations environment. And that means we've got to sharpen our pencils pretty carefully.
Mm-hmm. I understand there's been some discussion among legislators, and perhaps you've heard about it, about a possible different way of considering Iowa's three public universities, either together or separately in the appropriations process. Do you have a view on that?
You know, that we sort of did that this year. When you look at the reductions that were made, especially both the rescissions to our 2017 budget and then the reductions that were made between 2017 and 2018, our reduction as a percentage of our state appropriation was smaller than that at Iowa and Iowa State. But as a percentage of our total general fund revenue, it was about the same. So there's this recognition that, you know, a little over half of our revenue stream is state appropriation, because we have somewhere between 85 and 90% of our student body is Iowa residents. While at Iowa and Iowa State, much of their revenue is coming from tuition dollars, and a good portion of that is from out-of-state tuition, out-of-state students. So there was a recognition that, you know, if they made a rescission or a reduction to our budget by the same percentage that they did Iowa and Iowa State, it was actually going to have a larger impact on our budgets. Mm-hmm. And so I think there has been some recognition of this difference, and that we are the institution that really does educate Iowans for Iowa. And so I think we've already seen it.
Mm-hmm. Related to that, UNI's student body, as you said, is 85, 90% Iowa residents, much higher than the other two public universities, ISU or the University of Iowa. Yep. I think it was the previous UNI president, Ben Allen, who called that high percentage of Iowa residents as students a bad business model. Do you see it that way?
You know, if you looked at it a pure business model and what your revenues are and things, it probably wouldn't be the thing that a CEO from business would choose to do. The state appropriates money to us not based on the number of students we have. So you really ought to be growing your out-of-state students. And we're not going to look at it quite that way. The one thing that I'm really committed to is making sure that we take as many Iowa students as we always have, at least as a percentage of the number coming out of Iowa high schools, right? We've got a commitment to serve Iowa and to educate those students and get them back into the Iowa workforce, and we do a really good job of that. We can't back off on that. I think we will look to bringing in a few more out-of-state students, because we've got some room in our institution for growth. But we're not going to do that at the expense of the number of Iowa kids that we continue to educate. Mm-hmm. You've got to balance those, especially at a place like UNI, where we're training teachers and we're training business leaders and we're training other professionals for the state of Iowa and the surrounding region.
Yeah, talk a little more about that, because workforce development in the state is a hot topic. Ensuring that Iowa's workforce is equipped with the skills, the education that employers in the state mm-hmm. need, and UNI's contribution to Iowa's workforce needs?
Yeah, a couple things. First of all, you know, in our last survey, 95% of our graduates were employed within 6 months or attending graduate school, continuing their education somewhere. Of those that were employed, 88% of them were employed back in the state of Iowa. Just a remarkable number of people returning to the Iowa workforce or entering the Iowa workforce. We've got key programs, especially in the College of Education, but also then in accounting and finance, business administrations, marketing, really strong programs in communications, communication arts, music. Sciences are getting stronger, and a lot of those students are going into the healthcare professions and the medical fields. Mm-hmm. The other thing, we've got alumni and teachers in every single county of this state. We've got our business and community services program that helps businesses and communities, counties, put together strategic plans and business plans, and we've worked with an organization or a business in every single county within this state. So we really are Iowa's comprehensive university. We're our region, the service region we have, is really river to river and border to border.
Hey, that's our name, river to river.
I thought I'd slip that in.
Well, let me ask you about research dollars. The federal government is a big supporter of university research across the country. Agencies like the National Institutes of Health, Science Foundation, the EPA. And in the budget year that just ended, both the University of Iowa and ISU brought in more money for research and scholarship from outside sources than in the year before. But federal support for research fell by millions of dollars at each of those schools. I wonder, does this impact UNI to any degree?
It does. We have some federal dollars that are involved, especially in our business and community services, but also in our science programs. We get money from NASA, from NIH, and a couple of other the organizations for research. And so it is important to us. It certainly isn't anywhere near the same percentage of our budget, but we do have ongoing research that is funded through various federal programs, some and from various organizations at the federal level.
Mm-hmm. Changes on campus, anything you're particularly proud of you want to mention there that you're seeing happening in the UNI campus?
You know, one of the things we want to do this next year, we'll be putting in to ask for funds to do a real upgrade to our industrial technology building. It's been a while since it's been touched. The programming there has changed, and so we really do need to go in there and make some changes to that. And many of these students that come out of that are going into the high-tech fields, and so we've got to make sure we've got the equipment, but we need to get them in some appropriate facilities so that we can better educate them. We've done some remarkable, I've just been blown away with what happens with our performing arts, the things that our music and theater students do, and the types of things that we bring into the Gallagher Blue Dorm Performing Arts Studio. I've never been on a campus or seen a campus that's a master's one comprehensive that has the impact on the local region's culture the way that UNI does. And then, of course, our sports programs and the academic quality as well as the on-court, on-field quality of those student-athletes is really over the top.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, your wife likes life in Cedar Falls and the new digs and all that?
She is really enjoying it. She was a music major in college and a volleyball athlete as well in college, so the opportunity to be at sporting events and musical events and getting to know students and people around the community, they've really reached out to her and she couldn't be happier.
President Nook, you are an astrophysicist by education. You have a doctorate in astrophysics?
Astronomy, a master's in astrophysics, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you will know that we have a total eclipse coming to North America next month, August 21st. Do you have plans to see it?
I'm hoping to be able to spend that day with my uncle who lives right on the center line over in Nebraska. So we'll certainly be there. I've been to one other total eclipse, and it's really an awesome event. If you get an opportunity at all to get inside the zone of totality, you should do it. It'll go dark. You can kind of see stars around the sun. It looks like twilight. It's a really unique experience to see a total eclipse.
We have to hope for a cloudless
That's
day.
Right. Yep.
All right. Wonderful to talk with you, President Mark Nook of the University of Northern Iowa. We appreciate you coming into our studio. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks again, Ben. I really appreciate it.
A little of the Northern Iowa fight song for President Nook as he leaves the studio. Coming up in just a moment, we'll look at Russia's actions in our 2016 election through the eyes of a former CIA officer, in fact, a graduate of the Iowa State University in the late 50s. Tom Twetten is retired now, but he's a former deputy director for operations at the CIA. More than four decades of experience in U.S. intelligence. We're going to ask him to give us his view of the Russian meddling and the much-talked-about meeting Donald Trump Jr. had last year. When we return, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Tom Twetten. We've had him on our program before. He is a retired deputy director for operations at the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. Twetten was twice awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Medal. That's the CIA's highest intelligence award. And he's a graduate of Iowa State University. Tom Twetten, welcome back to our program.
Thank you very much, Ben.
We called you to take a few minutes to pick your brain, to have you share with us how you're seeing this unfolding story of the Russian investigation with its weekly revelations through your eyes, the eyes of a former high-level U.S. intelligence officer, someone who has been part of the intelligence community for more than four decades. In a minute, I wanted to have you comment on Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting that's been in the news the last couple of weeks. But before that, perhaps we could start with a sort of big picture and have you react to that. We know the consensus among all U.S. intelligence agencies, the CIA included, is that Russia meddled in our 2016 election campaign with the intent of helping Donald Trump, something, by the way, that is still not entirely accepted by President Trump. We have a special counsel, Robert Mueller, investigating many aspects of this, including the possibility of collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Putting that part aside, so what? We know Russia is an adversary. Espionage is part of the game in the darker corners on the world stage of geopolitics. They seem to have gotten the better of us here, caught us off guard. Isn't all fair in love and war between adversaries?
Well, if you're a proud member of the American democracy, it isn't acceptable for foreign powers to interfere with our affairs. And it is in the long history of the Cold War, which I was a part of for those decades, they never did. And we never did. There was something we called Moscow rules, which, to my knowledge, were never breached. They said, in effect, unwritten, that we would never interfere in each other's internal politics.
That they would
we
never
recruited each other's citizens and military officers and spies, but we did not interfere in Communist Party politics, and they did not interfere with American democracy. Mm-hmm. So this is unprecedented.
How much confidence do you have that Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation will get to the bottom of this?
I would say 99% plus. He's a very fine man and very experienced in working with intelligence and law enforcement together. I just don't think there could be a better person for the job. Mm-hmm. It's going to take him some time because it's pretty complicated. But I would say give it 12 to 18 months and we'll have a great deal of information on it.
12 to 18 months. Does Robert Mueller and his people, do they have, from what you understand, access to all intelligence from the various U.S. branches, the NSA, CIA, and so forth?
Yes.
Okay, so he can get whatever access he needs.
And he'll have the eager cooperation of the American law enforcement and intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Tom Twetten, now you retired after 34 years, I think, from the CIA in 1995. And so it's been a long time since you've worked actively in intelligence. But can you tie in what is happening today with what you did back then? See it through that historical lens.
Yes. I think not very much has changed. We saw the Russians as our primary adversary. The Russians played the intelligence chess game well. They had their intelligence services had problems with their political masters who didn't always accept the information they were given. But they were a very good active intelligence service, and we played the game about the same way. We were very good at recruiting Russian intelligence officers who told us what they were up to. So we had a full book on their intentions and what they regarded as most important, and we were often able to give the FBI detailed information or at least leads on Americans who had been subverted by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all still going on, and to the best of my knowledge, in the same way. The only thing that's different is that Putin, a former member of the KGB, the Russian intelligence, is now the president, and he's still playing intelligence games as a part of his politics.
How does that square in your mind with President Trump's desire to shift our longstanding hardline U.S. approach toward Russia, or its position on Ukraine and NATO and other issues? He's really trying to make a fundamental change here. If you say we're still more or less in a Cold War mindset, and Putin is, how does that square with what the president's vision is?
Well, of course, I can't speak for Trump. He, I think, saw, because Paul Manafort was his campaign manager and had done business with the Russians in the Ukraine, I think there was a beginning bias toward, let's see if there's a Russia opening.
Mm-hmm.
And that started early on in the campaign before Manafort was fired. Then came, and I think this could be characterized as the first or the second move of a chess game, the Russian effort to have a meeting with Trump Jr.
Okay. So let's talk about that meeting. You're talking about the meeting that took place in June of 2016. Donald Trump Jr. at that meeting. Donald Trump Jr. recently told Sean Hannity of Fox News this about that meeting with a Russian lawyer who was said to have damaging information about Hillary Clinton. He said on Fox News, "It was such a nothing. There is nothing to tell." His words. Tom, from what you know, with your more than four decades of work in intelligence, does Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting that also included son-in-law, the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and then campaign manager Paul Manafort, as you mentioned, does it sound like a nothing, or does it sound like a Russian intelligence operation?
Well, it's very clearly a Russian intelligence officer operation. The beginning moves of trying to build some relationship with the Trump campaign, I would accept Donald Jr.'s comment that nothing happened in terms of dirt on Hillary being passed over. But the purpose of the meeting from Russian intelligence was to test the waters, to take the measure of Trump Jr., to get some sense of whether the Trump campaign might be willing to accede to Russian interests.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent a reliable person, but the person didn't have official status. This is a standard operation for a professional intelligence officer. They want it deniable. They're very careful, and they want to be able to deny that anything happened if it goes badly.
Oh, so this Russian, you're speaking of this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, was there in what capacity do you think representing the Kremlin? They wanted enough distance that they could deny it if it didn't work out, if it was not an opening? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So this meeting, from what we know about it, fits in with standard espionage tradecraft, as far as you can see, from a Russian perspective?
It fits in with Russian tradecraft because it's quite subtle. It's not blunt, they are one of the best, and they were part of what they were doing was testing to see if the Trump campaign would report this meeting to American legal FBI authorities, and they did not.
And so what did that tell the Russians, do you think?
That tells the Russians that the Trump campaign is partly naive and partly willing to I'm saying naive because I'm not sure that many in the Trump campaign realize that it's illegal to accept anything of value under American finance campaign laws. Anything of value cannot come from any foreign power, any foreign person. And when the Trump campaign does not report that, the Russians are able to measure that nothing is different in FBI behavior, so so they have the possibility of Trump being cooperative either in the campaign or after he's elected.
Mm-hmm. For the listeners who've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Tom Tweten, retired deputy director for operations at the CIA. He retired in 1995, also a graduate of Iowa State University, today joining us from Vermont. Isn't it also possible, Tom, that in this meeting with Donald Trump Jr. that included Jared Kushner and campaign manager Paul Manafort, that the Russians in that meeting were, as a possibility, were unconnected with the Kremlin, that they were simply rogue operators? Is that a possibility?
Not in the Russian system, because these people are people of substance in Moscow, and it would be very dangerous for them to go off on their own. If something went badly, they would be they would lose their position of access and well-being in the Russian system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you see any other explanations for that meeting besides the ones that we've talked about?
I think there is one piece that I do need to tell you, which is historic, and that is there's a piece of revenge here, because at the end of the Cold War we had Russians coming to us with full of democratic ideas and ask us if we could provide them with a Russian translation of our Bill of Rights and our Constitution, and they wanted, we had a brand new intelligence liaison with Russia, and they were full of grand ideas of how to reform their system.
Mm-hmm.
This eventually, under Gorbachev and Yeltsin, led to a robust parliament, freedom of the press, valid elections, multiple independent parties, the beginnings of real, true democracy in Russia. And in that context, we at the CIA said, no, this is not our covert business. We need to have the State Department overtly give democratic help. And the State Department has done a wonderful job of this over the last 25 years around the world, funding NGOs and groups that support democracy in any number of countries. So there has been a huge change in democracy participation and human rights around the world in these 25 years. Now, along comes the last election of Putin, and there were several non-government organizations that were funded by the State Department that put money and wherewithal into the hands of opposition groups in Russia, and that's democracy. Unfortunately, Putin is not a Democrat, and he took umbrage to this. And he particularly was angered by the fact that the State Department, a U.S. government organization, was doing this, and the Secretary of State happened to be Hillary Clinton. Well, guess what happened? He decided to take revenge. And he took it in a covert series of ways. Both of his intelligence services are involved in this. But there's no doubt in my mind that the primary purpose of this evil man, Vladimir Putin, a professional intelligence officer, was to defeat Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. So now in the present, and this is really a difficult question to answer because you'd have to be in President Putin's head. But what do you imagine President Putin, given that background, what do you imagine he thinks of the Russian scandal unfolding here in the U.S. and this investigation that is bound to go on for, year and a half or so, perhaps, if not years?
Good question, because I think you can make some pretty good guesses about Putin's head. He has had what he felt was a successful operation. He did influence to some degree. I'm not sure we will ever know to what extent. It's quite possible that Trump would have been elected whether he had Russian help or not. But he did interfere with the election, no doubt about it, and he was initially quite pleased. Now the problem is the goals are turning sour because there's increasing anger over this. Mueller's going to put out a very thorough report when it comes, and Russian interest in Ukrainian sanctions being lifted, Russian interest in showing themselves to be a great power are going to be diminished in this country when the Mueller report comes out.
Mm-hmm. So you think it looks very much like this has backfired on Putin, that the investment in the meddling in our election will have backfired and created a...
In this country, I don't think the Russians have enough knowledge of it since they no longer have a free press. They don't really know what's going on in the U.S., and they don't accept that Putin was even involved because there's so little information available to the average Russian.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt in my mind that Putin is unhappy and trying to figure out how to decrease the damage that's coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, at this point, and it unfolds very quickly, by the day, by the week, and will in the coming months, we'll find out much more than we know at this point. But for you as a former intelligence officer, what are the biggest questions in your mind? Are there things that don't make sense or things, blank spots that you would like to have filled?
Well, I'm saddened. I think the biggest thing that's because this is so unprecedented, I'm saddened that the president has not yet acknowledged that this is a problem for future American relationships with the Russians, and that the Russians need to be have their slapped, more sanctions, more penalties put down on them, so they get the clear message that we will not tolerate their interference in American democracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Tom Twetten, for being so nice to join us for this short time. Retired Deputy Director for Operations at the CIA, also a graduate of Iowa State University. We're reaching you in Vermont, Craftsbury Common. This is where you live these days?
Yes.
And so,
thank you, Ben. I enjoyed chatting with you.
Well, can I just ask you quickly, Tom, what do you do during the day here? What activities do you have?
Well, I'm active in the antiquarian book business, and I do do a fair amount of reading to keep up with current affairs, and I'm still playing tennis, so I have a busy life.
Excellent. Glad to hear from you. Hope to talk to you again at some point. Tom Twetten, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That conversation with Tom Twetten recorded yesterday. Coming up tomorrow, our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River, I'll talk with Iowa's Secretary of State Paul Pate about National Voters with Disabilities Week. That's this week. Also, about President Trump's Advisory Commission on Election Integrity, which held its first public meeting this week. That was a commission proposed by President Trump earlier this year to investigate his belief that as many as 5 million people voted illegally last November. That's an allegation dismissed as unfounded by the vast majority of the nation's election officials and experts. Also tomorrow on the program, I'll talk with the co-owner of a Waterloo Cedar Falls body armor producer. RMA Armament was invited to the White House as a part of a Made in America event hosted by the Vice President and the President. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.